Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
There may be a break in the budgetary logjam involving the Florida House, Senate, the governor, and the federal government.
Until we get clarity and visibility to the health care funding picture in Florida, then there can be no other priorities.
Also tonight, despite much opposition, a bill requiring a 24-hour waiting period before having an abortion is now headed to Governor Rick Scott.
Only a woman carries a child, and only a woman should have the right to decide if that is what she wants to do without having to wait 24 hours.
We'll also talk about helping veterans, reining in the power of homeowner associations, and find out what really goes on in the Florida legislature. It's the end of week 8 in the 9-week legislative session, and it's all downhill from here. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. After much hand-wringing, mud-slinging, and finger-pointing, there's a new development in the delicate budgetary ballet now playing out in the Florida legislature. Lynn Hatter brings us the latest.
The House takes $200 million in general revenue and steers it toward health care. It expects to pull down $300 million in federal matching funds to offer some support to hospitals if they lose a $2 billion low-income pool program that reimburses them for indigent care. That program expires this summer, and some hospitals say they could be financially devastated if it goes away. House Speaker Steve Crisafulli has said he won't backfill the LIP program with state money. Now, he says, the House offer attempts to get the conversation started, and hospitals should begin reevaluating their budgets.
And they've built their budgets around what I would call a lottery. I mean, this is money that's been coming to them for the last several years that they've built budgets around. And sometimes you have to restructure in businesses because revenue streams change.
The House is taking money from its tax cut plans and education funding proposals, but the hospitals would still face big shortfalls. The Senate, however, has $600 million in money set aside to fill the gap, and it would use that funding to draw down $900 million from the federal government. Under the Senate scenario, hospitals could break even, but state economist Amy Baker recently pointed out using state money is not an ideal situation.
You do not make the state whole relative to the impact of losing the federal dollars. And that's because you've lost those dollars from the economy. You're only realigning.
She says what realigning does do is lessen the impact of the loss of federal funds on the economy. The Senate has rejected the House's health care funding offer, and it's doubled down on its plan to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Baker told lawmakers the Senate's Medicaid proposal would save the state about $260 million in the first year and result in a budget surplus down the line. And the Senate wants to use those savings to increase its education funding plan to what's been proposed in the House. But when it comes to everything else, Senate Appropriations Chairman Tom Lee says the state has to address health care first.
And until we get clarity and visibility to the health care funding picture in Florida, then there can be no other priorities.
The House is now proposing to increase its state contribution to $600 million, matching the Senate's plan. But in return, the chamber wants the Senate to drop its Medicaid expansion stance. In a statement, House Speaker Steve Crisafulli says he does not think it's necessary for lawmakers to stay in Tallahassee until June 30th, something the Senate has proposed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A controversial abortion bill is now headed to the governor after receiving final passage from the Florida Senate today. Sasha Cordner has that story.
Miami Republican Senator Anna Terry Flores is the bill's sponsor.
This bill requires that the informed consent that is required to be given to a woman prior to be having an abortion, that informed consent be done 24 hours prior to her receiving that abortion.
Senate Democrats tried and failed to make changes to the bill that included putting a 24-hour waiting period in place for vasectomies by Miami Democrat Gwen Margolis.
If a man has a vasectomy, that he too has to have 24 hours notice, get lectured, go through the same process as a woman does. It's as simple as that. I mean, you know, it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
And that failed amendment was met with a joking response from Baker Republican Greg Evers.
Senator Margolis, would you accept an amendment on that that makes the requirement that a man has to wait 40 years before he has one of those?
By requiring the 24-hour waiting period, it means a woman would be required to make two visits. A new change in the bill exempts women who are victims of rape, incest, domestic violence, and human trafficking. But Orlando Democrat Geraldine Thompson tried to add another exemption.
Or when on the basis of a physician's good faith clinical judgment, there's a risk to the woman's health or the presence of a severe fetal anomaly incompatible with sustainable life.
But bill sponsor Flores disagreed.
What you would be saying is that if there is a chance that your baby may be born with some sort of anomaly here, call it ailment, whatever it is, then you've made the decision that that life just isn't worth it. And that's something that I could definitely not support.
Flores's bill also comes with a condition that those exempt must provide documentation like a police report or a restraining order, which has been met with much opposition. That includes Lake Worth Democrat Jeff Clemens, who failed to try to do away with that provision.
We're going to ask that woman who's been through this awful experience to walk in the door, not only admit she's been through that awful experience, but we're going to tell her, prove it. I hope nobody in here thinks that's right.
Still, Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell praised the measure.
This is not a hostile bill to women. It is putting women at the same level of everybody else, and it's making sure that we have the same standard for women as we do in every other medical procedure, and that there's not a business, the business of abortion, trying to take advantage of women and trying to play on their emotion and talk them into something that they make money on and you live the rest of your life regretting. We want to make sure that a woman has the time to sit back and reflect and then make that informed decision.
A view not shared by Senate Democratic leader Arthenia Joyner.
This bill is hostile to women. This is the only medical procedure that we mandate that a person, specifically a woman, has to go back home and decide, oh, did I make the right decision? Well, let me tell you, in a procedure this important, no woman wakes up and say, oh, I'll have an abortion tomorrow. They've thought about it.
Sharing a personal story, bill co-sponsor Niceville Republican Don Gates, who says he's never debated an abortion bill in his 9-year tenure, felt he had to this time. He spoke about his wife, Vicky, who's been paralyzed for about 30 years due to a rare complication that occurred when she was pregnant with their second child.
She had had an unexplained spinal cord injury, and the doctors told me she would probably die. She was pregnant, 4 months pregnant.
Gates says his wife was then told to consider having an abortion since time was of the essence.
So she thought about it, I think for a day or two. And then she came back and said, I'm going to live and my baby's going to live. And today our daughter, that baby, is a 29-year-old network television producer in New York. And she calls her mother every single day.
And bill sponsor Flores says that's what this bill is all about.
If all that this bill does is have one woman, just one, after some time of reflection, after some time of thought, say, I am going to make the decision to have this baby, I will consider that a huge success.
And the measure passed the Senate 26-13 with Democrats opposed. The measure will now head to Governor Rick Scott. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, there's a break in the feud between the Department of Juvenile Justice and several Florida counties.
Generally what happens is the counties have responsibility for a portion of this juvenile justice, and we can't get to any level of clarity going forward.
Lawmakers say a bill that's passed through the Senate gives homeowners a little room to push back against their associations.
This is a bill that at the end of the day is going to be good for homeowners. It's going to be good for our constituents.
From liberalizing hotel check-in rules to property tax cuts, lawmakers are eager this year to establish Florida as the most veteran-friendly in the nation.
I don't care if they're my constituents or whose constituents they are. It's, to me, it's a personal thing that I honor those people.
And the parliamentary procedure that guides the Florida legislature is complex, so today we have a conversation with a long-serving senator to discuss things like sine die.
It's Latin for, you know, we're done, we're through, we're finished.
Support for Capital Report is provided by The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust. Empowerment. Education. Employment.
A feud between the Department of Juvenile Justice and several Florida counties has been going on for years, but as Matthew Seeger reports, a judge's ruling gives the county's side a hope of a resolution.
In 2004, the Department of Juvenile Justice split the cost of detaining juvenile offenders with Florida counties. It required the counties to pay for the period during the trial, while DJJ would cover everything afterward. But situations with repeat offenders who are awaiting a new trial while still occupying the post-trial period from their last offense were never properly defined, and according to Brian Deloge, a Leon County commissioner, counties say the department is taking advantage of them and using the vague rule as a cover.
We feel pretty strongly we have been overpaying for a number of years, and so there's been a number of lawsuits to try and clarify that.
Craig Mosteller, communications director for the Florida Association of Counties, is relieved that the latest lawsuit succeeded.
DJJ has once again shown, and the judge has yet again ruled, that their haphazard approach to rulemaking is flawed and incorrect. And we have been dealing with a statute now for 11 years that DJJ has yet to interpret appropriately according to the judicial system.
On Wednesday, Administrative Law Judge W. David Watkins ruled the latest DJJ rule change, quote, constitutes an invalid exercise of delegated authority. The DJJ has spent years revising and tweaking its rules, and Deloge says that inconsistency only adds to the problem.
When the rules change all the time or there's kind of a moving target, it's very difficult for us as counties to budget going forward and try and figure out, well, how much will we pay or could we pay? Or are we responsible for paying?
Meanwhile, a pair of bills in the House and Senate that were meant to address this conflict have been stalled in the legislature, gathering dust and cobwebs since earlier this month. The bills proposed DJJ and the counties split the bill 57-43. And while Mosteller says she'd like to see it go 50-50, she's happy to see a concrete number.
Well, I mean, first I'd tell you that we're cautiously optimistic. While neither bill is where we would like to see it, the entire budget is stalled. So at this point, because this has a budget, an appropriation that would be attached to it, you know, we're certainly going to continue to wait and see how the process plays out.
There's barely a week left in legislative session, and the current budget stalemate means this might still be a no-go. But the counties have been playing the game of whack-a-rule for 11 years, and they hope next year will be the one. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Matthew Seeger.
Despite what some lawmakers call an outcry from homeowners associations and the companies that manage them, a bill that would help buyers get a better handle on any fees associated with buying a condo is not likely to be estoppeled now. What in the world does estoppeled mean? Regan McCarthy tells us.
When a person buys a unit in a condominium, they can sometimes be saddled with any of the past fees the previous owner failed to pay to the homeowners association. Before a purchase, the details of any outstanding fees are generally included in what's called an estoppel letter.
The manager finally comes in, pushes a button, and knows exactly how much they owe, you know, they owe on their maintenance or what they haven't paid in an assessment.
That's Miami Democratic Senator Gwen Margolis. She says estoppel letters have long been, in her words, a ripoff. Venice Republican Senator Nancy Dietert says the price the homeowners associations and their managers often charge for that piece of paper can be jaw-dropping.
What they've done is gouged so badly that we finally are forced to do something. They hold up closings. If you're sitting at a closing and they're going to charge you $1,500 to fill out one form, and you can either stop your closing and fight the association or just pay the $1,500 and be mad for a day and get over it. That's what's going on here.
And Lakeland Republican Senator Kelly Stargell is filing a measure to address that.
This is a bill that at the end of the day is going to be good for homeowners. It's going to be good for our constituents.
Stargell's bill puts a time frame in place for how quickly estoppel letters must be provided and how long they should be expected to remain valid. It prohibits homeowners associations from charging fees not included in the letter and requires the fee for producing the letter to be included in the letter itself. It also caps that cost. But Wellington Democratic Senator Joseph Abruzzo says he's hearing from hundreds of homeowners associations in his area this bill will hurt them.
I've gotten an outcry from the associations in my district, and I just wanted to read just a few. I've gotten letters from Bellagio Residential Association, Black Diamond Homeowners Association, Boca Falls Homeowners Association, Buena Vida Homeowners Association, Cascade Residential Association, Crystal Cove Estates Homeowners Association.
Abruzzo says the list of associations that have contacted him spans four pages, and he says the print is small. And Tampa Democratic Senator Arthenia Joyner says she's heard from associations the bill's changes could result in an increase in fees charged to the rest of the association members. That's because of concerns about the association's ability to collect fees for creating the estoppel letter during the house's closing, as well as questions about what happens if the house doesn't sell.
It's like telling someone to mow your lawn, but then saying they can't get paid for it unless your home is sold.
But Stargell says it's standard for costs like that to be worked out at closing. She says that's when homeowners will be dealing with several other fees, like a termite inspection. And Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee points out the state isn't exactly piling on to homeowners associations. Just last session, he says lawmakers passed a bill to help protect associations and their managers from accusations they were illegally practicing law. It's a separate issue, he says, but it's, in his words, not a zero-sum game. The measure passed through the Senate with a 33-6 vote. It's waiting for a hearing on the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
With the third largest military veteran population in the country, Florida wants to make itself the nation's most veteran-friendly. As Jim Ash reports, lawmakers are set to do anything they can this year to honor veterans.
It's down to the wire for the 60-day legislative session, and there are more than 100 bills hanging fire on the House floor. Both chambers are hopelessly deadlocked over how to handle a $4 billion budget shortfall and looking at overtime. But Republican Senator Greg Evers of Baker is at the Tallahassee Fairgrounds, greeting homeless veterans at hundreds of miles from his district.
Me, I don't care if they're my constituents or whose constituents they are. It's, to me, it's a personal thing that I honor those people.
Florida has more than 1.6 million veterans, one in every 12 residents. Half of the veterans are older than 65. The state boasts the largest World War II veteran population in the nation. That's one reason Evers is touring the North Florida Veterans Stand Down, an intensive three-day event that provides temporary housing, food, clothing, legal services, career counseling, and even veterinary services for the approximately 250 homeless veterans in Leon County. Evers listens closely to Washington Sanchez, chairman of the Florida Veterans Foundation.
Our job is to help veterans in need. And so that means if they are in possibility of eviction, we'll help them pay their mortgage. If there's a possibility of utilities being cut off, we will pay the utilities.
Sanchez wants to see a veterans court in Leon County, which he figures will cost $150,000. Evers wants to see a similar stand down in his district, but he can't make specific promises while the budget's fate is still so murky.
I'm going to do everything within my power and encourage my fellow members and representatives, members in the House.
The House doesn't take much convincing when it comes to helping veterans either. Republican Bill Hager of Delray Beach is pushing legislation that would allow underage military personnel to register at hotels and motels.
We have 21 military bases here. We have significant military operations in Jacksonville, in Pensacola, and we're going to continue to welcome all military personnel. We're going to continue to advise them that this is the state to be in.
Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association Vice President Richard Turner is eager to oblige.
For a very small group of people, it's a nice tip of the hat to our military. And while we generally don't, we're always wary of regulations, this is one of which we would support totally.
Senate Budget Chief Tom Lee of Brandon is ushering through legislation that gives a property tax break for military housing.
We don't want military housing installations done by public-private partnerships taxed. As you all know, we passed a military bill of rights.
Veterans groups may have to wait a little longer, however, to see how they did this year. It looks like the session is headed into overtime. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
You're listening to Capitol Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, for the sake of brevity, there's only so much how does this whole thing work you can pass along when you're doing a program like Capitol Report. So we toss around phrases like the bill is now headed to its third reading on the floor and the committee temporarily passed the measure without taking much time to explain just what that all means. There's just 1 week of session left and lawmakers are pulling out every trick in the book to get their bills across the finish line. So this week, Nick Evans sat down with one lawmaker to get an inside look at parliamentary procedure.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill.
Since 1975, Schoolhouse Rock has taught us every bill that becomes a law has to go through a process. Approval by the House, approval by the Senate, then off to the executive's desk for a signature. But that's just the veneer. Beneath that explanation of the process is a complex knot of rules, conventions, and etiquette. And there are a few lawmakers who understand that knot better than former Senate President Don Gates.
This is my 9th session in the Florida Senate. I never served in the House of Representatives. My background is in health care and education. I'm a former superintendent of schools, elected, not appointed.
Gates represents the state's first Senate district, which comprises much of the northwest portion of the Panhandle. He served as Senate President from 2012 to 2014. This week, the legislature passed one of its final landmarks along the way to the end of its regular session, the 50th day.
It means that committees stop meeting unless it's the Appropriations Committee. It means that notice requirements change as we get down to the last few sands in the hourglass.
Now, it's actually the Rules Committee that can continue to meet, but the point still stands. After the 50th day of session, committees, the highways bills travel toward final approval, close down. In the House and Senate, leadership assigns a handful of committee stops for each bill at the beginning of session. And if the bill hasn't successfully run that gauntlet by day 50, it's more or less dead. And if that time limit isn't enough of a hurdle, Gates explains lawmakers have to follow a specific set of rules for introducing, amending, and debating the proposals.
For example, here in the Florida Senate, we use Robert's rules, and we use Thomas Jefferson's original rules of legislative procedure as a guide, but then every year we maneuver and massage and work the rules of order to meet new exigencies. You know,
Robert is General Henry Martin Robert. He served in the U.S. military, and his Rules of Order was published in 1876. The Senate's Rules of Order is published as the paperback book. Think of your average novel, more than Gatsby, but not quite Copperfield. And it helps manage things like the amendment process.
Well, a good rule of thumb, and that doesn't always work, but it's a pretty good rule of thumb, is sort of last in, first out.
Gates offers an example of a bill with an amendment, a substitute for that amendment, and then a further amendment on the substitute.
First, you take up the amendment to the substitute amendment. You dispose of that. Then you take up the substitute amendment. You dispose of that as amended. And if the substitute amended as amended, passes, you don't need the main amendment, and you're back on the main bill with the substitute amendment as amended.
Okay, great. Wonderful.
Sounds confusing, but it really isn't.
And Gates explains the rules are important for handling objections to amendments, known as points of order.
Mr. Speaker, under Rule 12.8b3, the amendment substantially expands the scope of the bill to include provisions.
Under House Rule 12.8b3, an amendment is considered not germane if it is substantially expanded.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to call a point of order, but whether you want me to do it before
that
this.
That was Representative Mike LaRosa, Representative David Richardson, and Senator Jeff Brandis. And actually, they're all bringing the same point of order. Germanity.
Well, a germanity challenge is a very common rules challenge. What it simply means is the amendment that you're trying to put on my bill is not really related to the purpose of the bill or the title of the bill.
Gates goes on to explain that on the House or Senate floor, the presiding officer then makes a ruling based on the advice of the chair of the Rules Committee.
And here in the Senate, we have a guy named John Phelps. And I think he was originally hired by Andrew Jackson to interpret the rules here. He really knows everything there is to know. And so if John is advising the rules chair and the rules chair is advising the presiding officer, they're right.
Now, the lawmaker whose point of order has been put aside could bring a motion to overrule that finding. But Gates says he's never seen it. And that kind of breach of decorum carries consequences.
If such a motion were made, the senator making the motion might discover his parking place has been moved to Governor Square Mall, his office is in Sop Choppy, and his only committee assignment is the Committee on the Future of Florida Sidewalks.
But in addition to committees and amendments, both germane and otherwise, a bill has to get through three readings on the floor. The first reading puts the bill on the calendar. At the second, the bill's sponsor takes questions from the full body about the proposal, and fellow lawmakers can propose amendments. Then at the third and final reading, there's debate on the bill and another chance to offer amendments. With this crucible in mind, it's easy to see why so many bills die on the way to the governor's desk. But the surprising thing is just how sanguine Gates is about the process. The last question I asked was, what's the most interesting way you've seen a bill die? Instead, Gates told me about a last-minute compromise he made with former House Speaker Will Weatherford.
It was the last thing that we did before the close of session, and as a result, now children in Miami have more access to neonatal care when they need it, and now people all over Florida have chemotherapy that's more appropriate and less painful when they need it. And it was because of a speaker that was willing to work with the Senate President in the waning moments to put two bills together and get them passed so that neither idea would die.
As we move into the final week of session, with the House and Senate at odds over health care funding, it's unclear whether there is any chance of similar compromise before the hankies drop and the chambers adjourn, sine die. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
Regular Capital Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Matthew Seeger. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight during the 2015 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.